Did I miss the bell? That'd be a no. It's good to see everybody here tonight. We are in lesson 8. This is the second class devoted to that lesson. We're talking, as you can see from the slide, about family matters. We've been talking primarily about parents and their children. We'll say a little bit more about wives, husbands and wives this evening. Brian Rodriguez is here this evening. He worked with me for several months. I forget exactly how long before he and his family moved up to New Jersey, where he preaches full-time up there. So I think Brian has come back down to see if in the intervening time I have gotten any smarter. The answer is no. Sorry to disappoint you, but it's the same old dumb guy. Couple of quick housekeeping matters before we get started. Phil asked me to remind you, if you're going to be in an adult class, not teaching one or teaching a child's class, in the next session, which begins, June 3rd, next Wednesday, please sign up for a class. That gives the teachers an opportunity to know how much material to present, to prepare, if they're going to hand out material. I also wanted to remind you that the challenge I've placed before you in the Proverbs class is to select 6 Proverbs and to memorize those Proverbs. And the idea is that you want to pick Proverbs that would help you out with situations you face in life, or maybe they speak to some sort of weakness that you struggle with or temptation, and so that proverb would be a good thing for you to be able to remember. And I hope that maybe that would encourage us to go ahead and memorize even more proverbs or other passages. So hopefully everybody's picked their 6 proverbs, right? And they've learned 5, they're working on that 6th proverb, right? Can I get an amen? Don't lie. Okay, so work on those proverbs. There's no test, you know. It's up to you. Do what you feel like you want to do. But I would encourage you to do that. I picked my 6 proverbs, and I won't tell you which proverb I'm working on. I do want to spend just a few moments, since this is the second class of this particular lesson, in review. But we began the lesson last week, or Sunday rather, by talking about the importance of family. We're talking about family matters, and I gave you some quotations. Here are some different ones. This is by C.S. Lewis. He says, "The homemaker has the ultimate career. All other careers exist for one purpose only, and that is to support the ultimate career." I like that. It emphasizes how important the job of a wife and mother is, a homemaker. And we've looked at numerous proverbs already in this lesson that talk about the need for parents to instruct their children. We'll say some things about that again this evening. And that's the homemaker's career. And that is the ultimate career. Our society is of the opinion that that's a nothing job. If you really want to get out and do something important, you got to get out into the work world. Well, I'm sure there are important jobs in the work world. But you think about the job of a woman, a mother, who is forming the character, the moral guidance of a small child. And the effect of that training, as we'll see in Proverbs 22:6 this evening, will go with them for the rest of their lives. That's huge. I don't know of any job that would be more important than that. So here's another, if we can get it to come up here. Michael J. Fox, you know, he suffers from Parkinson's. He was an actor. "Family is not an important thing," he wrote. "It's everything." And to some extent, I agree with that. Family is so important in so many different ways. That's why we're talking about the importance of families. I'm not sure what's going on here, but for some reason, it's not. There we go. "In time of rest, family is best," a Burmese proverb. Thought we'd mix in another proverb here while we're talking about proverbs. What does that say? Well, when you've got a problem, when things are, you know, maybe going bad, you need to be able to count on family. Family is who you really want to go with. My dear young cousin, Rick Riordan writes, if there's one thing I've learned over the eons, it's that you can't give up on your family no matter how tempting they make it. Do families sometimes make it tempting to give up on them? Yeah, we're all imperfect people, right? And sometimes we do stupid things. Sometimes we don't act the way we should. But he said, don't give up. You can't give up on your family, he writes, in kind of a backhanded way. Wow. I think we may need a new battery in this thing. Albert Einstein, rejoice with your family in the beautiful land of life. What's Einstein saying? Before you know it, your family's gone. Your parents are gone. Siblings die. Rejoice with them while they are here. Because the time will come when perhaps, you know, the things you wanted to say or things you wanted to do, it's all gone. You can't do that. Do it while you are in the beautiful land of life. Okay, let me see if I can speed this up a little bit by going here. Well, not going to be able to do that. Can I get you to change the battery on this thing, or maybe it needs to be charged because it's not... It's not advancing. I'll tell you what we'll do while they're messing with that. There are some things that we talked about in the last class that I wanted to review. We're going to work through these questions pretty fast. I saw it up here briefly, and then we lost it. Well, these are some principles about discipline, parental instruction. We talked about last time, we'll just go ahead and reemphasize them. One of the things we talked about a great deal is that corporal punishment, when it's divorced from instruction, is abuse. If you're punishing a child without making it clear what the boundaries are, what the expectations are, then you are just basically abusing your child. I'm going to go back to this, and then we'll pick up with the rest of those. That was something we talked about quite a bit. Another thing we talked about was that we need to be careful about disciplining in anger. We were talking about that in the context of parental abuse. It's very easy for parents when they get frustrated, I forget who it was that talked about that over here, when they get frustrated to then over-discipline or discipline improperly, being actually abusive, physically abusive to their children. Discipline needs to be consistent. We talked about the fact that sometimes parents get tired. Children don't always respond the first time, and so parents get tired, and so they make promises. If you do such and such, you're going to be punished, you know, and they'll tell, this is what you need to. But then when the child disobeys, they don't follow through. Discipline needs to be consistent. If it's not consistent, what's the effect on the child? Well, frustration is one thing, yes. What else? Yeah, Melanie? Okay, you've lied to them. They don't believe what you're saying. And a consequence of that is they don't ever know if you're serious when you say something, because today you enforced it, tomorrow you didn't. So they're going to push. They don't know where the boundaries really are. And then one other thing that we talked about, and Jenny Williamson had a comment about this, and I missed her hand. She talked to me about it afterwards. Punitive discipline needs to be appropriate for the seriousness of the infraction. You don't spank for everything. What happens when you spank for everything? When you're quick to spank all the time? Your discipline becomes subject to the law of diminishing returns. What is that law? You have to keep more and more in order to get the same effect. So you reserve certain more severe forms of discipline for those things, those infractions that are more severe. We talked about the difference between children who just forget to do something or forget what the rule is and children who are just frankly rebellious. Jenny made the observation that different children, and we talked a little bit about that in class, that children are not all the same in the same family. My two sons, Jonathan and David, have very different personalities in some ways, especially when they were young. You don't discipline maybe all of your children the same way. Some children are much more docile, much more ready to submit to parental authority. Others are quite rebellious. My father-in-law used to tell me that they never spanked Debbie, which when I married her, I found out that was probably true. She was just some... No. What they meant was we never had to. He said, I would just look at her with disapproval and she would just go to tears. And I believe that. I'm not sure. He may have exaggerated. But I believe what he was saying was true. She has an adopted sister who was on the other spectrum of things. And so you have to deal with each child in a way that is appropriate for that child. It's not always going to be the same. Sometimes children will complain, well, you know, you're harder on this child than you're... Well, the difference is this child listened, you're not listening. So listen, and then you won't get the discipline that you've been getting. See what I'm saying? Jenny, well, that might be why it's not working. I'm kicking it around up here. We'll see if it works now. And so Jenny mentioned that also. It wasn't me, I promise you. It was not me. Let's see if we can get it to go. Huh? It's rebelling. It's rebelling, yeah. And I'm going to treat it with some discipline. There's going to be some corporal discipline here if we don't get things going. I'm going to point to you, and if you'll just advance the slides, and I'm pointing to you right now. There we go. So here's, this is by Barbara Bush. She says, wrote, I think togetherness is an important ingredient of family life. Would you agree with that? There are a lot of things important in family, family matters, but the time you spend together, togetherness, and our culture, our lifestyle, pulls families apart. Because we have so many opportunities, we can do so many things. And the electronic age has not been particularly friendly to families. Because we tend to disappear into our own little spheres of interest. We're not spending time together. Even when we're watching TV sometimes, we're all sitting quietly while somebody else dialogues with us and has our attention. We're not spending time together. How many families eat meals together? Not occasionally. Most of the time. How many families sit together when they eat supper, maybe breakfast too? Now, I will confess, I always had an advantage because my schedule was flexible. I didn't have to be at an office necessarily at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning, so I could make myself available to my family. But the fact of the matter is, if it's important to you, you can do that. You can make the changes that are necessary to spend time with your kids in the morning before they go to school. Before you go to work, you spend time at a supper table, whether, you know, it may not always be the same time, but you're going to spend time because you're going to get a chance to talk about what happened at school, what's going on with their friends, the things that are happening in your family. And that discussion, you're teaching, you're instructing all that time. That's togetherness. I think that's what Barbara Bush was talking about. I think she's right. Let's go to the next slide here. So this was one of the questions we discussed. Go to the next slide. And here's some of the information that we talked about. And the primary message of those proverbs that we looked at is that parents are going to be affected by the behavior of the children, not just when they're at home, but even later when they're older, they're adults, they moved away from home, because we still have this connection. Now, sometimes children move away a distance and we don't have the close connection that we have if they were local, but we're going to be affected by our children. And the sad part about it is if you don't do the work now, they'll break your heart later. And you can't do a whole lot about it once they become independent and they're off doing their own thing. Their lives have been formed. Let's go to the next slide. In fact, the next slide, I'm going to run right through these because we've already read these. Go there and go. So what's the proper motivation for parental discipline? What are the principles do you notice in these Proverbs? Let's go to the next slide. Obviously, the proper motivation is love. And we talked about the fact that love, if we're talking about the love that the Bible encourages husbands, us toward our enemies, is a matter of moral choice where we pursue the best interest of another. Agape love, if you want to work with the Greek word there. And these Proverbs that we looked at identified the goal of corrective discipline. You're going to try to save your child from a lot of heartache and difficulty, trouble in the future. Discipline is designed to drive foolishness from the heart of a child, designed to deliver his soul from Sheol, and you need to discipline while there is hope. 1918, the New King James Version. All right, let's go to the next slide and the next and the next. You're going to get double pay tonight, Doug. And so here's the question that we had just started to look at the end of our class on Sunday. What is the general truth behind Proverbs 22:6? Here's Proverbs 22:6 in several different versions. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. The New Living Translation, the NIV are just pretty much the same. But I want you to look at the CSB down at the bottom there. Start a youth out on his way. Even when he grows old, he will not depart from it. That's a little bit different, isn't it? That doesn't say you should direct him into the path that he should go. You're just starting him out. Well, you can hardly avoid doing that. But that's not what this proverb is trying to say. This proverb is saying that you need to try to set the path that is the right path, he says, in a child. Start a youth out on his way. Even when he grows old, he will not depart from it. The general truth is what? Early training is very influential. We've said some things about that in the last class. We do need to remember this is a proverb. It's a statement of general truth. What is that? What's the implication of that for this proverb? What is it? I'm sorry, go ahead, Kevin. It's not going to be absolute. It's not going to work in every case. It's generally true that if you train up a child in the way that he should go, he will stick with that. There are going to be certain things that you will encourage in a child when they're young, and they may never escape those things. Certain characteristics, certain moral ideas, choices. Yeah, Eric.
You're making a point there, but if it's absolute, then you can never overcome your training.
Right. Do parents sometimes give children bad training? Sure they do. And if it's absolute, then that child, you know, is pretty much destined for failure because he can't change it. If you say this is absolute, you're really neglecting an important fact about our nature. What is that? We have free will. Even children have free will. Now, we guide their will. We make a lot of choices for them. But they still have the ability, the free will, to choose whether to accept instruction and reproof, or to reject it. God had spiritual children in the Old Testament, right? Israel? Did they always follow what God told them to do through the covenant, through the prophets? No, absolutely not. In fact, most of the time they didn't. So that makes God a bad parent, right? No. We are remembering that Israel has the ability to choose life, right, and blessings, or evil and death, curses. That was Sunday's sermon. Two choices. And Israel often chose the wrong thing. Children often choose not to listen to their parents. Now, if a parent doesn't teach the child, that's on the parent. But when the parent gives the instruction that's necessary, that's important, that's good, and a child doesn't listen, then that's on the child. And the parent is not necessarily responsible for that. Yes?
As with the Israelites, they're around
Okay, yeah. Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point. Kevin's point is, just like the children of Israel, the question of who you spend time with, who's influencing you, will have a big difference as to whether or not you follow the right path. What did God say to Israel when they came into the land of Canaan? Kill everybody. Well, yeah. He said, don't give your daughters to the sons of the Canaanites, and don't take their daughters for your sons. Don't intermarry with them. Why? Because you're going to be influenced by them. Get rid of their altars. Destroy their idols. Why? Because they will influence you. And that's exactly what happened to Israel. That was prophetic. And so God was trying to avoid that influence. What we're talking about is the influence of parents early on in life. I think there's a tendency in some Bible students to forget that this is a proverb. So we look at a child, maybe a young person who's already in teenage years or maybe has left home, and we say, well, that child is not very spiritual. That child's not living a godly life. That must have been bad parents. Is that a fair conclusion? I don't think so. It might be true, but I don't think you can say with absolute certainty that that's the truth. And the reason is that child has a choice about the parental instruction. I don't think we as parents can excuse ourselves from responsibility because our child is doing things or is misbehaving. But on the other hand, I don't think we can assign bad parenting to parents because their child refused to listen to their instruction. What's the lesson here? Get busy and instruct. Do the training when they are young. Yes, sir.
That point to me is very important. We can't give ourselves too much of a pass by forgetting that it is a proverb, which does mean it's usually true.
There's some truth there.
So I think for how long now can you talk to so many congregations across the country, and their problem is they're losing all of their domain. If we're losing all of the youth, or most of the youth, then those of us that are the generation that raised children, we need to think about what we've done that maybe has contributed to that, so that we can help what's left do better than what we do.
Yeah, and I think your comment gets back to Kevin's comment. Who are our children spending time with? Well, you know, they go to school for several hours a day during the school year, right? So they're basically in the pool of foolishness there because they're with a lot of other kids who in many cases are not being instructed along godly lines. Maybe they've chosen friends that are poor. What kind of influences are they being subject to in terms of our digital entertainment industry? All of those things get back to Kevin's comment that influence, especially when they're young, is extremely important. Very, very good comment. Zach?
I think maybe with one child, we might not be able to draw any absolute conclusions about behavior of some children and what the parents did or did not do, but we are called to, when a man is getting elder, one of the
right, having faithful children, Titus 1:6.
That says something about how they leave the church. If they don't have anything to do with how a child behaves, then I'm not sure why that qualification would be there. But if you have six children, they all have been very rebellious. And I think you can make some wisdom call, maybe not a judgment call, but like some sort of, I think it says something.
I'm gonna just repeat your comment. I'm not gonna pursue it because that opens us up into a very large area that I don't really want to get into. I want to stay with the Proverbs that we're looking at. But your comment about, you know, how much or how many children end up going off into unrighteous behavior says something perhaps about whether the parent is responsible. And as parents, even with our grown children, we can still have influence with them as long as they're having contact with us. We're able to have contact with them. Don't make any judgments about me based on Jonathan. But you know, that's true. I think that's a very true thing. I see Philip's hand and Robert's hand, and we're going to take those comments, and then we're going to move on to the next slide. Let's go to the next slide, please. Philip, go ahead.
A few comments about that problem in general. So paying attention to what it says and also what it doesn't say there. When you talk about all those external influences, those are part of the training of the child. I mean, your teachers, your friends, but also is your child on electronics? Are they, you know, going to your Bible class teachers? All those things are part of training. It doesn't just say training parents give, so it's to train a child where they should go.
Okay, let me stop and repeat that because it's your voice is soft. It's hard for the Zoom people to hear. Philip's comment is that part of the parental training involves what kind of influences they're subject to via digital entertainment and that sort of thing. And parents need to be involved in all of that. Good comment. Go ahead.
The second point I would make is just that having some experience with debating on this proverb that the inverse of the proverb is not necessarily stated. So sometimes people will make the argument saying, well, this can't be universally true because the inverse isn't true, but that's not a requirement to understand the proverb. Well, if you train them poorly, they can't come back. That's not addressed by this proverb. And so it kind of is requiring the inverse to be true that isn't necessarily there, and that tends to not go over well when you're trying to talk to somebody about a different understanding of the proverb. Follow what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I'm understanding correctly. The comments that were made earlier about whether this is an absolute truth. You would agree that a proverb is a. Okay. Well, that's the only important thing, is that you agree with me. No. Yeah, I think we need to be careful that we don't, you know, decide about the inverse, accept the proverb for what it says. And what the proverb says is that early training is very influential. And I've seen that in my own life. I've seen it in the lives of others that I've known from childhood on through adulthood. You see their parents in them. Their parents train them to think and do in certain ways. And you see that influence. It's not all-encompassing. I'm not a clone of my father. But you do see that influence, and I think that's an important concept. Robert, you had a comment as well.
In prior to the proverb, himself had his child issues.
Yeah. Yeah. King David was a godly individual. I don't know what kind of a parent he was. There's some question in my mind about his parenting skills based on Amnon, Absalom, Solomon, some of these. Although David gave good example, advice, counsel to Solomon when Solomon takes the throne. But you're right, Solomon apparently didn't convey that righteousness onto his child, and he had problems, as 1 Kings 11 suggests. All right, so I shouldn't have had Doug do this quite so fast. This is a comment by James Dobson I think is good. When a parent loses the early confrontations with the child, the later conflicts become harder to win. The parent who never wins, who is too weak or too tired or too busy to win, we talked about all those things in the last class, is making a costly mistake that will come back to haunt him during the child's adolescence. If you don't win the battle of authority when they're young, you will not probably win it when they're adolescents. Because now they're becoming more independent, they're thinking more for themselves, and you haven't won the battle early on. If you can't make a 5-year-old pick up his toys, it's unlikely that you will exercise any impressive degree of control during his adolescence, the most defiant time of life. It is important to understand that adolescence is a condensation or composite of all the training and behavior that has gone before. Now, James Dobson is not inspired, but what he's saying is correct if we understand the Proverbs. We're looking at Proverbs 22:6. Look at Proverbs 19:18. Chasten your son while there is hope. Do not set your heart on his destruction. Someone says, well, I don't want to oppress his spirit. Listen, you better mold his spirit or you are planning his destruction. You're planning his ruin. Because he will eventually end up having to face consequences much more severe than a parent who's unhappy with them, with him. So think those are good things to think about. If anybody else has a final comment. Yeah, Kevin? Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a perfect illustration at that age. I mean, kids are just consumed. Well, even earlier and older, they're consumed with electronic communication. iPads, phones, computer games, all of this stuff. I got to be honest with you, and I don't want to be negative or anything, but I am so glad that when our boys were young, we didn't have that stuff. The kids went outside to play. They played board games. They did other things. We didn't have, we had television. Okay? And those are challenges that parents today have to face that are enormous challenges. And parents need to develop some idea of what's appropriate, what's useful, and keep those rules. You know, one of the things I've noticed about the Amish, you know, people look at the Amish and they're backward, they're fanatics about certain things. But you know what? Teenage Amish young people, at some point, they have the opportunity to spend a couple of years out in the world if they want. Wilding, they call it. And the vast majority of those kids come right back to the Amish community. You know why? Because they have been taught certain values, and they go out into the world, and the world's so different, they come back to the Amish community. Now, I'm not plugging all of the Amish community standards. I'm saying they have rigid standards of appropriate behavior, and it shows in their young people. I said you were going to get the last, but Nathaniel, you don't speak up a whole lot. Go ahead. They are.
More like the perspective of teach your kids how to appropriately use it. Like, for example, my parents let me use YouTube until I was probably my late teens. And by then, they had taught, like, okay, here's how you safely use this thing. Mm-hmm. It, you know, I think you've spoken on social media in the past, it's a tool. You can use it back.
Right.
You're good. And for parenting, it's okay. You teach them how to use it.
That's a good comment. I'm not up here to say social media is just terrible, everything about it is bad. We live in a media world. We live in a digital age. There's no getting around that. But we do have to adjust to it. We do have to adapt to it. We have to use biblical principles to make sure that that's being used as a tool and not something that is going to be bad influence. Good comment. All right, let's go to the next slide here. And what do these proverbs have in common? Let's start reading them on the next slide. Proverbs 13:1, a wise son hears his father's instruction, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. 15:5, a fool despises his father's instruction, but whoever heeds reproof is prudent. And the New King James Version, substitutes the word correction for reproof in the second half of the proverb. To the next slide. Cease to hear instruction, my son, and you will stray from the words of knowledge. My son, give me your heart and let your eyes observe my ways. All right, so what impressions do you get from these proverbs? How do you define a wise son and a foolish son?
Listening or not listening?
Yeah. Ralph is using sign language now. But that's right. The wise son is the one who's described as listening to instruction. The foolish son is the one that will not heed correction or reproof. Correction and reproof is harder to take, right, than just straight instruction. It's harder for a child to take the parent's rebuke or correction, say, what you did was wrong. But that has to be. But I want you to notice that in the first two Proverbs, that's the way you identify whether he's a wise son or a foolish son. What's his attitude toward instruction? What's the problem with young people? Why is it that young people don't want to listen to instruction? Everybody's turning around and looking like somebody else is going to answer this question. Yeah, Greg?
I think they know everything.
Yeah, somebody else said it too. They know everything. Listen, when I was a teenager, I really had a hard time listening to my dad. We would fuss over things. I remember in the dining room, us standing on opposite sides of the table, the kitchen table, the dining room table rather, and arguing about whether love was an emotion or love was an action. And we were like oil and water on stuff like that. Young people think they know everything. But what's the truth? Okay, they don't. Yeah, they don't. And what young people need to be told and understand is that adults have often been through the very same kinds of things. Young people seem to think that the world is always different than it was for the parents. Is it different? Okay, I saw someone go, yes, no?
Exactly.
Yes, no, exactly. Explain yourself, Robert.
The difference, we do have differences in the world of information technology, but we also have the same principles still apply.
Okay,
that's where it's yes and no.
Yeah, God's truth doesn't change, and those truths, those principles, define how we behave. Talk about life like family members in chapter or lesson 9. We'll talk about social matters or relationships. Those things don't change. But we do live in a little different world. We live in a world that is vastly different than, say, for instance, when I was a kid, where TV had three channels and it was black and white. And we didn't have computers. You know, I know some of you are thinking, do you guys drive ox carts? Is that how you got around? No, we had cars. Of course, they were old sedan with the fake wood on the side and everything. But the world has changed in some ways. But there are principles, there are truths that are just the same. There are challenges that young people face that are exactly the same kind of challenges that I faced when I was a kid and that you faced, if you're an adult, when you were a child. Yeah, Eric. Very good point, that you can build generational knowledge and wisdom from one generation if people are willing to accept instruction. I'll give you a good illustration of that. My dad's parents were not Christians. My mom's parents were not Christians. They weren't converted to Christ until I was already born. Cheryl was already born. I don't remember how old we were, but we would have been like 7 and 6 or 7 and 5, something like that. And so mom and dad, in a way, started kind of from ground zero. But they taught us, and so we were ahead at the age when we got married than my parents were when they started having children. And then we taught our children. Our children have the benefit of the wisdom that hopefully we've gained over. You can do that, and each child then of the next generation has a bigger advantage in terms of understanding and the wisdom accumulated. That's an important concept. I want you to notice that in the first two Proverbs that we were reading on the previous page, there was just observations. Go ahead and hit the next slide, if you would. Observations about who's wise and who's foolish. You know, young people are foolish if they don't listen to the instruction of their parents. That doesn't mean necessarily that everything a parent says is wise, does it? You know some unwise parents? Well, yeah, they exist. They're not like the dinosaurs. They didn't go extinct or anything. But you need to listen, and there needs to be the acceptance of things that you may not necessarily agree with as a young person. I'm preaching to parents. But you can convey that to your children. The second two, these Proverbs that we were just looking at, they're both exhortations. Give me your heart, the father says to his son. Let's see if there's anything else. That's all I'm going to say about that. Let's go on to the next question here. Question number five, what's the point of these two Proverbs? Let's go to the next and read a little bit about them. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. The New Living Translation, always a paragon of translational accuracy, says the man who finds a wife finds a treasure and he receives favor from the Lord. 1914, house and wealth are inherited from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. The NLT again, fathers can give their sons an inheritance of houses and wealth, but only the Lord can give an understanding wife. Let's go to the next one. So, what's the point here? Is it that every wife is necessarily a good wife? Now, before I notice all the men are like this. I'm not making a move. Especially if your wife's sitting next to you, you just like let Alan talk and get himself into trouble. All right. Not all women are good wives.
But all good wives, yeah.
And the relationship of marriage. Ralph said, all good wives are from God. Why? Explain what you meant by that.
God bless, because I'm willing to serve God, and God gives me a wife that's a good wife. It is from God.
If your wife is a good wife, it's because she's following the precepts that God has set out. So God does give us good wives. I think the general truth here is not that every marriage is two people who are just wonderful people, who are good people, but that marriage is a good thing. The man who finds a wife, this is a good thing. And I think that's an important principle to take out of the Proverbs, because our culture beats marriage like a dog. Marriage is oppressive. Marriage is restricting. You know, it's have you ever heard someone say marriage is slavery? Well, I've read that any number of times. Marriage is slavery. And so people decide not to get married. Then maybe they'll, shack up, but they're not going to marry because that's restricting. You know, I don't want to make that kind of a commitment. What if it doesn't work out? That sort of thing. But what these Proverbs are saying is that a wife is a blessing from God and that marriage is a good thing. When a man finds a wife, that's a good thing. And that's from God. Who is it that in the beginning said, it's not good for man to be alone? That was God. God created Adam. Paraded all the animals before Adam, let him name the animals. What was the point of that? God couldn't, tell Adam what the names were or make the names up for himself. He wants Adam to see there's no other creature in the created world that is comparable to him. And then he creates Eve. And he creates Eve from Adam. Yeah, Mike.
I think Stephen when you start looking at why did he talk about inheritance doesn't require any action. Inheritance is just something that happens. Maybe one day my son will inherit something from Angie and I. That requires no action. But I also think that even though the good wife comes from the Lord, it seems to me that there's some action involved in someone like me in finding that good wife and that good wife. There's decisions that have what if that's not the reason there's the juxtaposition of inheritance with the good wife and the Lord?
Let me repeat Mike's comment that maybe these proverbs are emphasizing more than simply a wife is a good thing, but that there's action that is involved in decisions in having a wife, whereas inheritance just comes to you. I think maybe there's another possible explanation, and that's the relative value. You know, your parents can leave you houses and wealth, you know, inheritance, lots of. But what about a good wife? What's the value of a virtuous woman? That's from God. I'm sorry? Yeah, more precious than jewels, one version says. All right, excellent comments. Appreciate all of the good constructive comments. On Sunday, we will go on to lesson 9, despite the fact that we have not completed all the questions, like that was a surprise to you. And we'll finish up our study of Proverbs on Sunday. The next class in the auditorium is Works of the Flesh, Fruit of the Spirit. We're going to work our way through Galatians 5, 19 through 21. In the second class, remind me, what's in the second class? Phil Davis is teaching characters, major characters, major lessons from minor characters in the Bible. I forget that because the only class that I think is really going to be, no, never mind, forget that. Y'all have a good rest of the week. See you on Sunday. Okay, let me. Oh, of the virtuous one. Should I make a list? No, you're right. I'm gonna graft it in since marriage is a social relationship. Yeah, yeah. We'll bring it into that and hit the last question. Okay.
Boy, that's a lesson.
Yeah.